Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. What we have been doing for some months now is exploring the myths about money. Our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest, to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. We've been specifically looking at a book called The Web of Debt, which unravels the deception and presents a clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are heading. It then explores workable alternatives, particularly one that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. It helps us to analyze and improve our own financial security, personally and nationally, and to deeply understand the cause of the problems we are personally experiencing financially. At the onset, I give an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 books and scores of articles on debt-related matters. I highly recommend her book, The Web of Debt. You should also visit her website by the same name. You could also go to www.kruufm.com under Archives to listen to all of the shows produced on this and other debt-related topics. This particular series is under Life and Debt Web. In the last show, we ended up talking about the graft and greed in the credit card business. We did that in reference to the 2005 bankruptcy bill, which was essentially written by and for credit card companies, and a massive amount of money was dedicated through the credit industry to lobbying and creating the bill, some figure between $70 and $100 million. Credit card debt had reached $735 billion by 2003, more than 11 times the TAB in 1980. Approximately 60% of credit card users do not pay off their monthly balances, and among those users, the average debt carried on their credit cards is close to $12,000. This is what we call a subprime market, and the subprime market is actually targeted by banks and credit card companies, which count on the poor, the working poor, and the financially strapped to not be able to make their payments. According to The Two Income Trap, a book by Elizabeth Warren and her daughter Amelia Warren Tyagi, quote, more than 75% of credit card profits come from people who make those low minimum monthly payments. And who makes minimum monthly payments of 26% interest? Who pays late fees, overbalance charges, and cash advance premiums? Families that can barely make ends meet, households precariously balanced between financial survival and complete collapse. These are the families that are singled out by the lending industry, barraged with special offers, personalized advertisements, and home phone calls, all with one objective in mind: get them to borrow more money. End quote. This is actually all part of a strategy based on historical experience for making profits in the credit industry. Similarly, the payday lender operations offering small paycheck advance loans have mushroomed in the last decade, particularly popular in poor and minority communities. They can offer usurious interest rates as high as 500 to 1,000%. The debt crisis has been blamed on the imprudent spending habits of people buying frivolous things, but Professor Warren and Amelia Tiaghi observed that two-income families are actually spending 21% less on clothing, 22% less on food, and 44% less on appliances than one-income family spent a generation earlier. The reason is that they are spending substantially more on soaring housing prices and medical costs. And of course, those numbers were taken when the book was written in 2003 and have exacerbated tremendously since then in these two categories, housing prices and medical costs, which are often the catalyst creating a bankruptcy situation. In 2003, the average family was spending 69% more on home mortgage payments in inflation-adjusted dollars than their parents spent a generation earlier, and 61% more on health needs. Another important factor is that at the same time, real wages had stagnated or declined. Most people are struggling to get by with less, and in order to get by, many turned to credit cards to pay for basic necessities, which, of course, I see in my practice every single day. People are using their credit cards as bank account savings just to survive. Credit card companies and their affiliated banks capitalize on the extremity of poor and working class people by using high pressure tactics to sign up borrowers they know can't afford their loans, then jacking up interest rates or forcing customers to buy insurance on the loans. People who can make only minimal payments on their credit card bills wind up in debt peonage to the banks. The scenario recalls the sinister observation made in the Hazard Circular, which was said to have been circulated during the American Civil War. Quote, "Slavery is but owning of labor and carries with it the care of the laborers, while the European plan, led by England, is that capital shall control labor by controlling wages. This can be done by controlling the money. The great debt that capitalists will see to is made out of the war and must be used as a means to control the volume of money." End quote. In other words, the slaves kept in pre-Civil War South had to be fed and cared for. People enslaved by debt must feed and house themselves. Now, looking at the justification for allowing lenders to charge whatever interest the market will bear, seems to state that it recognizes the time value of money. Lenders are said to be entitled to this fee in return for foregoing the use of their money for a period of time. That argument might have some merit if the lenders actually were lending their own money, but in the case of credit card and other commercial bank debt, they aren't. And I'll come back to this in a moment. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. As I said, then, the argument by the banks is that they are entitled to a fee, that is the interest, in return for foregoing the use of their money for a period of time. And that argument might have some merit if the lenders actually were lending their own money. But in the case of credit card and other commercial bank debt, they aren't. They aren't even lending their depositors money. They are lending nothing but the borrower's own credit. Obviously, this is hard for us to grasp, and the whole purpose and scope of this show is to hit on this point. It's just like what the Chicago Fed said in Modern Money Mechanics, quote, "Of course, banks do not really pay out loans from the money they receive as deposits. If they did this, no additional money would be created. What they do when they make loans is to accept promissory notes in exchange for credits to the borrower's transaction accounts. Loans, which are assets, and deposits, which are liabilities, both rise by the same amount," end quote. So in the credit card scheme, it's like this. When you sign a merchant's credit card charge slip, you are creating a negotiable instrument. A negotiable instrument is anything that is signed and convertible into money or that can be used as money. The merchant takes this negotiable instrument and deposits it into his merchant's checking account, a special account required of all businesses that accept credit. The account goes up by the amount on the slip, indicating that the merchant has been paid. The charge slip is forwarded to the credit card company, Visa, MasterCard, etc., which bundles your charges and sends them to a bank. The bank then sends you a statement, which you pay with a check, causing your transaction account to be debited at your bank. At no point has a bank lent you its money or its depositors' money. Rather, your charge slip, which is a negotiable instrument, has become an asset against which credit has been advanced. The bank has done nothing but monetize your own IOU or promise to repay. Think of it this way. When you lend someone your own money, your assets go down by the amount that the borrower's assets go up. But when a bank lends you money, its assets go up. Its liabilities also go up since its deposits are counted as liabilities, but the money isn't really there. It is simply a liability, something that is owed back to the depositor. The bank turns your promise to pay into an asset and a liability at the same time, balancing its books without actually transferring any pre-existing money to you. This then becomes a spiraling debt trap. And as a spiraling debt trap, it has subjected financially strapped people to usurious interest charges for the use of something the lenders never had to lend, which effectively makes this a fraud on the borrowers. In 2006, profits to lenders from interest charges and late fees on U.S. credit card debt came to $90 billion. Since then, this has grown in great leaps. Down the road, we'll look at alternatives for retaining the benefits of the credit card system without feeding a parasitic class of unnecessary middlemen, but that's for the future. But now let's move on to the principal lure these days in the consumer debt trap, the illusion of home ownership. Just like Dorothy said in The Wizard of Oz, there's no place like home, there's no place like home, there's no place like home. If the bait that caught third world countries in the banker's debt web was the promise of foreign loans and investment, for Americans in the first decade of the 21st century, it would be the lure of home ownership and the promise of ready cash from home equity loans. Increased rates of home ownership were glorified as a bright spot for labor in an economy in which workers continued to struggle. In 2004, home ownership was touted as being at all-time highs, hitting nearly 69% that year. This figure, however, was highly misleading. 69% of individuals obviously did not own their own homes. The figure applied only to households. And while legal title might be in the name of the buyer, the home wasn't actually owned by the household until the mortgage was paid off. Only 40% of homes were owned free and clear. And that figure included properties owned as second homes, as vacation homes, and by landlords who rented the property out to non-homeowners. So this is where the statistics and the numbers are used in a very misdirected, misleading way, particularly to the middle class. Even homes that were at one time owned free and clear could have mortgages on them after the owners were lured by lenders into taking cash out through home equity loans. As a result of refinancing and residential mobility, most mortgages on single-family properties were less than 4 years old as of 2004, which meant that they had a long way to go before they were paid off. And if the mortgages were less than 3.3 years old, the homes were not subject to the homestead exemption for some states under bankruptcy law and creditor collection. That meant they could be taken by the banks even if the strapped debtors filed for bankruptcy. The touted increase in home ownership actually meant an increase in debt. Households owed more debt relative to their disposable income than ever before. In late 2004, mortgage debt amounted to 85% of disposable income, a record high. The fact that interest rates approached historic lows appeared to keep payments manageable, but the total amount of debt rose faster for the typical family than interest rates declined. As a result, households still ended up paying a greater share of their incomes for their mortgages. Total U.S. mortgage debt increased by over 80% between 1991 and 2001, and residential debt grew another 50% between 2001 and 2005. From 2001 through 2005, outstanding mortgage debt rose from $5.3 trillion to $8.9 trillion, the biggest debt expansion in history. In 2004, U.S. household debt increased more than twice as fast as disposable income, and most of this new debt money came from the housing market. Homeowners took equity out of their homes through home sales, refinancing, and home equity loans, totaling about $700 billion in 2004, more than twice the $266 billion taken 5 years earlier. Debts due to residential mortgages exceeded $8.1 trillion, a sum larger even than the out-of-control federal debt, which at that time hit $7.6 trillion the same year. So how did this happen? It was a trap, but it was a trap that was baited by seductively low interest rates and teaser rates. The housing bubble was another ploy of the Federal Reserve and the banking industry for pumping accounting entry money into the economy. In the 1980s, the Fed reacted to a stock market crisis by lowering interest rates, making investment money readily available, inflating the stock market to unprecedented heights in the 1990s. When the stock market topped out in 2000 and started downward, the Fed could have allowed it to come to a natural correction, but that alternative was politically unpopular and would have meant serious losses to the banks that owned the Fed. The decision was made instead to prop up the market with even lower interest rates. The federal funds rate was dropped to 1%, launching a credit expansion that was even greater than in the 1990s, encouraging further speculation in both stocks and real estate. If you're just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So what we have seen is that the Fed had set the stage. Banks and other commercial lenders fanned the housing boom into a blaze with a series of high-risk changes in mortgage instruments, including variable rate loans that allowed nearly anyone to qualify to buy a home who was willing to take the bait. by the year 2005, about half of all U.S. mortgages were at adjustable interest rates. Purchasers were lulled by teaser rates into believing they could afford mortgages that in fact were liable to propel them into inextricable debt, if not into bankruptcy. Property values had gotten so high that the only way many young couples could even hope to become homeowners was to agree to an adjustable rate mortgage, or ARM, a very risky type of mortgage loan in which the interest rate and payments fluctuate with the market conditions. The risk of ARMs were explained in a December 2005 press release by the Office of Comptroller of the Currency. Quote, "The initial lower monthly payment means that less principal is being paid. As a result, the loan balance grows or amortizes negatively until the sixth year when payments are adjusted to ensure the principal is paid off over the remaining 25 years of the loan. In the case of a typical $360,000 payment option mortgage that starts at 6% interest, monthly payments could increase by 50% in the sixth year if interest rates do not change. If rates jump 2 percentage points to, let's say, 8%, monthly payments could double." End quote. Homeowners agreeing to this arrangement were gambling that either their incomes would increase to meet the payments burden or that the housing market would continue to go up, allowing them to sell the home before the sixth year at a profit. But by 2006, the housing bubble was topping out, as in every Ponzi scheme, the vulnerable buyers who got in last would be left holding the bag when the bubble collapsed. And even borrowers with fixed rate mortgages could wind up paying quite a bit more than they anticipated for their homes. Loans are structured so that the borrower who agrees to pay a 30-year mortgage at a fixed rate of 7% will actually pay about 2.5 times the list price of the house over the course of the loan. A house priced at $330,000 at 7% interest would accrue $460,379 in interest for a total tab of $790,379. The bank thus actually gets a bigger chunk of the pie than the seller, although, get this, it never owned either the property or the loan money, which was created as it was lent. And the homes are completely secured, so the risk to the bank is very low. The buyer will pay about 2.5 times the list price to borrow money the bank never had until the mortgage was signed. And if he fails to pay the full 250%, the bank may wind up with the house. As you homeowners know, for the first 5 years of a 30-year home mortgage, most of the buyer's monthly payments consist of interest. For adjustable rate mortgages, the loans may be structured so that the first 5 years' payments consist only of interest, with a variable rate loan thereafter. Since most homes change hands within 5 years, the average buyer who thinks he owns his own home finds on resale that most, if not all, of the equity still belongs to the lender. If interest rates have gone up in the meantime, home values will drop and the buyer will be locked into higher payments for a less valuable home. If he has taken out a home loan for equity that has subsequently disappeared, he may have to pay the difference on the sale of the home. And if he can't afford that balloon payment, he will be reduced to house serfdom, strapped in a home he can't afford, working to make his payments to the bank. William Hope Harvey's dire prediction that workers would become wage slaves has come to pass. The homestead laws that gave settlers their own plot of land have been largely eroded by 150 years of the business cycle in which the bankers have periodically raised interest rates and called in loans, creating successive waves of defaults and foreclosures. For most families, the days of inheriting the family home free and clear are a thing of the past. Some individual homeowners have made out well from the housing boom, but the overall effect has been to put the average family on the hook for a substantially more expensive mortgage than it would have had a decade ago. Again, the real winners have been the banks. As market commentator Craig Harris explained in a March 2004 article, quote, essentially what has happened is that there was a sort of stealth transfer of net worth from the public to the banks to help save the system. The public took on the risk, went further into debt, spent a lot of money, and the bank's new properties have appreciated substantially. They created the money and lent it to you. You spent the money to prop up the economy, and now they own the real property, and you're on the hook to pay them back an inflated price for the property. They gave you a better rate, but you paid more for the property, which they now own until you pay them back. End quote. The larger a pyramid scheme grows, the greater the number of investors and borrowers who need to be brought in to support the pyramid. When the prime market was exhausted, lenders had to resort to the riskier subprime market for new borrowers. Risk was offloaded by slicing up these mortgages and selling them to investors as mortgage-backed securities. Securitizing mortgages and selling them to investors was touted as spreading the risk, but the device backfired. It wound up spreading risk like a contagion, infecting investment pools ranging from hedge funds to pension funds to money market funds. In a November 2005 article called Surreal Estate on the San Andreas Fault, Gary North estimated that loans related to the housing market had grown to 80% of bank lending, and that much of this growth was in the subprime market, which had been hooked with arms that were quite risky, not only for the borrowers, but for the lenders. North said prophetically, quote, even without a recession, the housing boom will falter because of the arms. These time bombs are about to blow, contract by contract. If nothing changes, if short-term rates do not rise, monthly mortgage payments are going to rise by 60% when the readjustment kicks in. Yet buyers are marginal, people who could not qualify for a 30-year mortgage. This will force for sale signs to flower like dandelions in the spring. If you remember the SNL, Savings and Loan Association, crisis of the mid-1980s, you have some indication of what is coming. The SNL crisis in Texas put a squeeze on the economy in Texas. Banks got nasty. They stopped making new loans. Yet the SNLs were legally not banks. They were a second capital market. Today, the banks have become SNLs. They have tied their loan portfolios to the housing market. I think a squeeze is coming that will affect the entire banking system. The madness of bankers has become unprecedented. Banks will wind up sitting on top of bad loans of all kinds because the American economy is now housing sale driven. End quote. The savings and loan industry collapsed after interest rates were raised to unprecedented levels in the 1980s. The commercial bank's prime rate, the rate at which they had to borrow, reached 20.5% at a time when the SNLs were earning only about 5% on mortgage loans made previously, and the negative spread caused them huge losses. When mortgage-backed securities were developed, banks succeeded in offloading mortgages by selling them to investors, but the banks could still be liable in the event of a default. The banks were also heavily invested themselves in securities infected with subprime debt. And we will continue in the next show. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life in Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeindebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.